Autopsy on a Puppet, An Anatomy of the Supernatural. Atmosphere. Billions of years had to pass following the formation of the Earth before its atmosphere became atmospheric. This transition could only have occurred with the debut of consciousness, parent of all horrors and the matrix of atmosphere. With our bodies bogged down in the ordure of this world, our new faculty instigated the genesis of other worlds, invisible ontologies that infiltrated appearances. Now we could feel the presence of things beyond the reach of our physical senses. The circumference of our fears dilated with further expansions of consciousness. Under the cover of atmosphere, there seemed to be another side to the realm of being we knew, or thought we knew. Seeing shadows in the moonlight and hearing leaves rustling in the wind, our ancestors impregnated these sights and sounds with imaginings and apprehensions. Atmosphere had finally arrived, both foreshadowing horror and taking its substance from horror. Without this alliance, the first horror stories could not have been told. As the horror story matured and branched out, so did the qualities of its atmosphere, most of all among the great names of this literary genre. For these writers, the atmosphere of their works is as unique as a signature or a fingerprint. It is the index of an identifiable consciousness that has been brewed from an amalgam of sensations, memories, emotions, and everything else that makes individuals what they are and predetermines what they will express as artists. Thus Lovecraft, in a 1935 letter to Catherine L. Moore, wrote these remarks on the weird story. "It must, if it is to be authentic art, form primarily the crystallization or symbolization of a definite human mood, not the attempted delineation of events, since the events involved are, of course, largely fictitious and impossible. These events should figure secondarily, atmosphere being first. All real art must somehow be connected with truth, and in the case of weird art, the emphasis must fall upon the one factor representing truth, certainly not the events, but the mood of intense and fruitless human aspiration typified by the pretended overturning of cosmic laws and the pretended transcending of possible human experience." The works in which Lovecraft most successfully put his theoretics of atmosphere into practice are paradigms of weird or supernatural horror fiction. Yet he wrote himself off as a failure in his pursuit to get on paper what he had in his head, and strove to the end of his life to do what no other horror writer had done before him, nor will ever do, lay bare his consciousness in an artifact. By the stress he placed on atmosphere, Lovecraft showed the way to an analysis of this element in horror literature, and, by extension, to an evaluation of the genre as a whole. While his personal use for atmosphere was to facilitate a sense of cosmic laws being overturned and human experience being transcended, he also defined the general purpose of atmosphere in horror stories, to give consistency, mood, to an imagined world in which we can at least pretend to escape from our mere humanity and enter into spaces where the human has no place, and dies to itself either weeping or screaming or in awe at the horror of existence. Here lies the paradox of consuming horror as an escapist venture. The secret of atmosphere in supernatural horror is simplicity itself. Already spoken of in the first paragraph of this chapter, it is here repeated and made categorical. Atmosphere is created by anything that suggests an ominous state of affairs beyond what our senses perceive and our minds can fully comprehend. It is the signature motif that Schopenhauer made discernible in pessimism, that behind the scenes of life there is something pernicious that makes a nightmare of our world. This something, this ominous state of affairs beyond what our senses perceive and our minds can comprehend, has previously been discussed in connection with Blackwood's The Willows. In this story, Blackwood was careful not to dissipate with explanatory details the atmosphere he created. Lovecraft admired this work for its evocation of nameless presences that remain nameless and yet are powerfully felt. This is not a rule that Lovecraft himself often followed, as is particularly evident in his later stories. In such works as The Dunwich Horror and At the Mountains of Madness, Lovecraft details, analyzes, and, unlike Blackwood in The Willows, names the monstrosities at the center of these narratives. Nevertheless, there are always unparalleled images and ideas in Lovecraft's fiction that stay with the reader and instill a feeling of unknown horrors surpassing those that have been made known. From the perspective of atmosphere, horror fiction may be dated only as far back as the novels of Anne Radcliffe, which contain enough visionary mood to make up for their bodice-ripper plots. Radcliffe's genius resided in turning a rage in the late 18th century for the picturesque in natural topographies into one that emphasized sublime dread as an aesthetic. Her works are known for the descriptions they contain of landscapes featuring mountains of intimidating height, valleys vast and deep, and moody twilights. Here quoted is such a view as witnessed by Emily Saulbert, the heroine of Radcliffe's most popular novel, The Mysteries of Udolpho. In this scene, Montoni, the story's malefactor, is delivering Emily and her aunt to his home. Please bear with yet a few more long excerpts, ones from a long novel in which Radcliffe at length and often entertained her readers with sublimely thrilling carriage rides. Towards the close of day, the road wound into a deep valley. Mountains, whose shaggy steeps appeared to be inaccessible, almost surrounded it. To the east, a vista opened that exhibited the Apennines in their darkest horrors, and the long perspective of retiring summits rising over each other, their ridges clothed with pines, exhibited a stronger image of grandeur than any that Emily had yet seen. The sun had just sunk below the top of the mountains she was descending, whose long shadow stretched athwart the valley, but his sloping rays, shooting through an opening of the cliffs, touched with a yellow gleam the summits of the forest that hung upon the opposite steeps, and streamed in full splendor upon the towers and battlements of a castle that spread its extensive ramparts along the brow of a precipice above. The splendor of these illumined objects was heightened by the contrasted shade, which involved the valley below. "There," said Montoni, speaking for the first time in several hours, "is Udolpho." Emily's initial sighting of Udolpho elicits the same kind of tingling sensation she feels for nature's mixed effects of minatory gigantism and soul-striking splendor. Emily gazed with melancholy awe upon the castle, which she understood to be Montoni's, for though it was now lighted up by the setting sun, the Gothic greatness of its features and its moldering walls of dark gray stone rendered it a gloomy and sublime object. As she did, the light died away on its walls, leaving a melancholy purple tint, which spread deeper and deeper as the thin vapor crept up the mountain, while the battlements above were still tipped with splendor. From these, too, the rays soon faded, and the whole edifice was invested with the solemn duskiness of evening. Silent, lonely, and sublime, it seemed to stand the sovereign of the scene, and to frown defiance on all who dared to invade its solitary reign. As the twilight deepened, its features became more awful in obscurity, and Emily continued to gaze, till its clustering towers were alone seen, rising over the tops of the woods, beneath whose thick shade the carriages soon after began to ascend. The extent and darkness of these tall woods awakened terrific images in her mind, and she almost expected to see banditti start up from under the trees. At length the carriages emerged upon a healthy rock, and soon after reached the castle gates, where the deep tone of the portal bell, which was struck upon to give notice of their arrival, increased the fearful emotions that had assailed Emily. While they waited till the servant within should come to open the gates, she anxiously surveyed the edifice, but the gloom that overspread it allowed her to distinguish little more than a part of its outline, with the massy walls of the ramparts, and to know that it was vast, ancient, and dreary. From the parts she saw, she judged of the heavy strength and extent of the whole. The gateway before her, leading into the courts, was of gigantic size, and was defended by two round towers, crowned by overhanging turrets, embattled where, instead of banners, now waved long grass and wild plants that had taken root among the mouldering stones, and which seemed to sigh as the breeze rolled past over the desolation around them. The towers were united by a curtain, pierced and embattled also, below which appeared the pointed arch of a huge portcullis, surmounting the gates. From these, the walls of the ramparts extended to other towers, overlooking the precipice, whose shattered outline, appearing on a gleam that lingered in the west, told of the ravages of war. Beyond these, all was lost in the obscurity of evening. The horrid vicissitudes of Emily's stay at Udolpho further extend the spirit-stirring and densely atmospheric world in which she is immersed. To move along the plots of her essentially romantic narratives, Radcliffe entrapped her heroines in castles so great and gloomy that their dungeons seem to have dungeons, and their towers appear to the imagination to sprout supplementary towers into infinity. Within such gargantuan settings, Radcliffe's young women are terrorized by men of a wicked nature. They are also terrorized by simulacra of the supernatural that are later exposed as being natural in origin. Then they are rescued by their beloveds and, presumably, live gladsome lives unmarred by their traumatic experiences. Some readers and critics disapprove of Radcliffe's ex post facto rationalizing of what seemed at the time to have been depictions of bona fide supernatural events, which for them dispels much of the frightful atmosphere she worked so diligently to create. The protest is that if she did not explain her way back to nature, her protagonists would have had to look into the face of a metaphysical horror that challenges one's concept of reality, rather than the lesser horror of having to marry a man of bad character. It must seem a paradox, then, that Radcliffe is credited here as the parent of supernatural atmosphere, when there are no supernatural happenings in her narratives. The resolution to this paradox is discussed in the section Supernaturalism later in this chapter. For now, let us listen to what Lovecraft had to say about Radcliffe as an author who set new and higher standards in the domain of macabre and fear-inspiring atmosphere, despite a provoking custom of destroying her own phantoms at the last through labored mechanical explanations. To the familiar Gothic trappings of her predecessors, Mrs. Radcliffe added a genuine sense of the unearthly in scene and incident which closely approached genius, every touch of setting and action contributing artistically to the impression of illimitable frightfulness which she wished to convey. A few sinister details like a track of blood on castle stairs, a groan from a distant vault, or a weird song in a nocturnal forest can with her conjure up the most powerful images of imminent horror, surpassing by far the extravagant and toilsome elaborations of others. Nor are these images in themselves any the less potent because they are explained away before the end of the novel. The only real disappointment of Radcliffe's novels is that she did not follow through on the death threats to her main characters with their actual deaths, which, considering each of her novels in whole, burns off some of their atmospheric setup with the resplendent sun of a happy ending. But to leave her heroines or heroes lying dead at the end of one of her narratives would have violated the terms of the genre of Gothic romance in which she wrote. And that would truly have been a blemish on her record as an adept storyteller. Atmospherically, death itself had not yet been added as an element to concentrate the effect of a horror tale. The next innovation in atmosphere began with Poe in the early 19th century. Poe was familiar with Radcliffe's works, which laid the groundwork of the Gothic genre and registered brisk sales. Possibly in reaction to Radcliffe, he turned the world of scenic thrills and salvation upside down in The Fall of the House of Usher. The story begins at evening, as its narrator approaches on horseback a secluded mansion flanked by a swampy and putrid-looking tarn. While the House of Usher may at first seem to be oozing an enchanting Gothic atmosphere, the narrator goes out of his way to argue that this is not so. The dilapidated manse, which has a deep crack running across its facade, is not sublimely desolate in the manner of the ruined castles of Radcliffe's novels. It is rather a locus of indomitable despair. Here is how we see the Usher estate through the eyes of the character who has come to visit the old pile. I know not how it was, but with the first glimpse of the building, a sense of insufferable gloom pervaded my spirit. I say insufferable, for the feeling was unrelieved by any of that half-pleasurable, because poetic sentiment, with which the mind usually receives even the sternest natural images of the desolate or terrible. I looked upon the scene before me, upon the mere house and the simple landscape features of the domain, upon the bleak walls, upon the vacant eye-like windows, upon a few rank sedges, and upon a few white trunks of decayed trees, with an utter depression of soul which I can compare to no earthly sensation more properly than to the after-dream of the reveller upon opium, the bitter lapse into everyday life, the hideous dropping off of the veil. There was an iciness, a sinking, a sickening of the heart, an unredeemed dreariness of thought which no goading of the imagination could torture into aught of the sublime. What was it, I paused to think, what was it that so unnerved me in the contemplation of the House of Usher? It was a mystery all insoluble, nor could I grapple with the shadowy fancies that crowded upon me as I pondered. I was forced to fall back upon the unsatisfactory conclusion that while, beyond doubt, there are combinations of very simple natural objects which have the power of thus affecting us, still the analysis of this power lies among considerations beyond our depth. It was possible, I reflected, that a mere different arrangement of the particulars of the scene, of the details of the picture, would be sufficient to modify, or perhaps to annihilate its capacity for sorrowful impression, and acting upon this idea, I reined my horse to the precipitous brink of a black and lurid tarn that lay in unruffled lustre by the dwelling, and gazed down, but with a shudder even more thrilling than before, upon the remodeled and inverted images of the grey sedge, and the ghastly tree stems, and the vacant and eye-like windows. However the narrator tries to relish rather than be distraught by the atmosphere of the house and its bedraggled grounds, he cannot do so. From the tenor of this beginning, the reader can expect no saving outcome. The atmosphere Poe created in the introductory section of his greatest tale is genuinely atmospheric because it bodes doom, which can mean only one thing, death. And in The Fall of the House of Usher, such is the portion of Roderick and Madeline, the brother and sister who are the last of their family to occupy the hereditary domicile. Furthermore, the precarious condition of the house worsens to the point where the structure itself begins to cave. To thicken this climate of demise, the light of a blood-red moon shines through a widening breach in the masonry of the Usher abode as it sinks stone by stone beneath the still surface of the noxious tarn. Earlier, the narrator told us of the identity that the local townspeople perceived between the House of Usher and its inhabitants. Admirably, Poe's tale culminates in the extinction of both. With this conclusion, Radcliffe's picturesque Gothic world had been supplanted by an atmosphere spilling out of death, the most ominous state of affairs with which we must deal. In his tales, Poe created a world that is wholly evil, desolate, and doomed. These qualities give consistency to his imagined world. And there is no escape from this world, only a fall into it. Poe's enclosure of the reader in an environment without an exit distinguishes his works from those of earlier writers like Radcliffe. His characters do not take us from place to place, looking at the scenery. They are inside a world that has no outside, no well-mapped places from which one can come, and none to which one can go. The reader of Poe never has the sense that anything exists outside the frame of his narratives. What they suggest is that the only thing beyond what our senses can perceive and our mind can fully comprehend is blackness, nothing. It is the same in those most atmospheric of experiences we all know, dreams. When you dream, you do not feel that anything exists which is not in your immediate surroundings. You cannot be anywhere in a dream except the place you are already in. Besides the psychological entrapment of dreams, there is also their fundamental strangeness, and Poe was expert at insinuating this phenomenon into his stories. Reading The Fall of the House of Usher is like having a lucid dream. We know that everything we see is unreal, yet there is paradoxically a heightened reality to it all. To awaken from such a dream is to lose your freedom from yourself and return to an onerous embodiment where consciousness is a tragedy and you cannot soar unscathed within an atmosphere of death. You can only die. It was almost a century after the 1839 publication of The Fall of the House of Usher that Lovecraft took a giant step in the art of atmospherics with his Call of Cthulhu. Well known as they may be to readers of horror fiction, the story's introductory sentences require transcription here. The most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far. The sciences, each straining in its own direction, have hitherto harmed us little, but some day the piecing together of dissociated knowledge will open up such terrifying vistas of reality and of our frightful position therein that we shall either go mad from the revelation or flee from the deadly light into the peace and safety of a new dark age. From Lovecraft's overture to this tale, the reader may surmise that, besides the death of a character or two, the human race itself may go under by voyaging too far on the black seas of infinity. While the statement is abstract, it is all the more atmospheric for being so, and we are ardent to read what dissociated knowledge, not a stunningly evocative phrase, has been pieced together by one Francis Wayland Thurston, who is displaced from his old reality and set into an ill-starred fictional world that makes all of his former days seem a heaven of naivete. "I have looked upon all that the universe has to hold of horror," F.W. Thurston writes after he has pieced together the puzzle, "and even the skies of spring and the flowers of summer must ever afterward be poison to me." In other words, he has done what no one has been in a position to do before him, sort out the worst of existence from any compensatory dividends, a process which leads him to conclude that life is a malignancy it were better not to know. This is Lovecraft's atmosphere, that of a world in which the frightful position he has placed all human existence could lead to universal madness or extinction at a moment's notice. Through this atmosphere, Lovecraft gives consistency to an imagined world where there is greatness in knowing too much of the horror of a planet in the shadow of Cthulhu and all that this implies about our existence. As for those people who still go about their ordinary, average business, complacently enjoying the skies of spring and the flowers of summer, innocently unaware of the monstrosities with which they coexist, they are children. They have no idea that there is nothing worth living for in Lovecraft's world. They are not in its atmosphere. Yet, at any time, they could be. It must be remembered that the atmosphere of a supernatural world and its horror exists only in the human imagination. There is nothing like it in nature, nor can nature provoke it. It is a contrivance of our consciousness, and only we can know it among all the organisms of the earth. We are alone in our minds with the atmosphere of a supernatural world and its horror. We are both its creators and what it has created, uncanny things that have nothing to do with the rest of creation. Theme. The literary world may be divided into two unequal groups, the insiders and the outsiders. The former are many, and the latter are few. The placement of a given writer into one group or the other could be approached by assessing the consciousness of that writer as it is betrayed by various components of his work, including verbal style, general tone of voice, selection of subjects and themes, etc. As any reader knows, such things do vary among authors. To pin any of them down within a capricious or oniric taxonomy of insiders and outsiders would then perforce become an experiment in uselessness. Ernest Hemingway, William Faulkner, Jean-Paul Sartre, Samuel Beckett, T.S. Eliot, Knut Hamsun, Hermann Hesse, who is on the inside and who is on the outside? The brain reels when considering well-known works by these writers, as they seem to express sensibilities at several arms' length from those of average mortals. Immediately we recall Hemingway's story, A Clean, Well-Lighted Place, which ends with a travesty of the Lord's Prayer, Our Nada, who art in Nada, Nada be thy name. Then our thoughts turn to the collection of degenerates in Faulkner's novels, which do not seem intent on showing off the nobler side, if there is one, of the human race. Nor should we forget Eliot's homage to entropy, the wasteland, or the unbalanced protagonists who lead us through Hamsun's hunger, Hesse's Steppenwolf, Sartre's nausea, and the entire output of Beckett. Conveniently, the status of these authors, insider or outsider, has been adjudicated for us by the Swedish committees that dispensed to each of them a Nobel Prize in Literature, which is annually given out to authors who produce the most outstanding work of an idealistic tendency. But should these literary greats be classed as insiders exclusively because they received a prize from a panel of Swedish judges? Some would say yes, but not entirely because of the Nobel. Some would say no, despite the Nobel. These conflicting opinions leave our job unfinished, insofar as determining the consciousness of an author to be that of an insider or an outsider. To expedite this inquest, we could use a candidate whose credentials unambiguously place him in the latter group. To fill this position, any number of worthy outsiders could be named. One of them is Roland Topor, whose short horror novel, The Tenant, is a document that expresses the consciousness of an unimpeachable outsider. To discern with a modest confidence what places a writer on the inside or the outside, The Tenant will be compared with another short novel that shares its theme, One, No One, and 100,000, by the Nobel Prize-winning Luigi Pirandello. In itself, theme is no giveaway of an author's consciousness. What counts is how that theme is resolved. Pirandello's resolution parades the symptoms of an idealistic tendency, while Topor's takes the anti-idealistic position. The theme of One, No One, and 100,000 is explicitly that of the self as a falsehood born of our systems of perception and cognition. In contrast to the dogma of the many, as Pirandello's narrator and leading character Vitangelo Mascarda comes to appreciate, the self is an insubstantial construct invented to lend coherence and meaning to an existence that is actually chaotic and meaningless. However well we function as bodies, we also recognize, because we are so often forced to do so, that they are unstable, damage-prone, and disposable phenomena. Simultaneously, we believe, until a malignant brain lesion or some life-rending event causes us to question this belief that our selves are more sturdy, enduring, and real than the deteriorating tissue in which they are encased. In One, No One, and 100,000, Moscarda is made aware of his misperception of his self, and, by extension, of the entire world of forms in which the self functions, by a misperception he has made about his body. Early in the story, he believes his nose to be evenly structured on its right and left sides. Then his wife tells him that his nose is not symmetrical, but is lower on the left side than on the right. Being an incurably pensive individual, Moscarda is troubled by his wife's remark. Being an intellectually honest individual, he has to admit it is true. That he misperceived this single feature of his appearance leads Moscarda to investigate what other delusions he has been entertaining about his appearance throughout his life. He ascertains a constellation of them. After scrupulous self-examination of his physical person, he grants that he is not the man he thought he was. Now he believes he is an outsider to himself, a figment in his own eyes and in the eyes of others. Later, Moscarda is condemned to further revelations. I still believed this outsider was only one person, only one for everybody, as I thought I was only one for myself. But soon my horrible drama became more complicated. This occurs when he discovers the 100,000 Moscardas that I was, not only for the others, but also for myself, all with this one name of Moscarda, ugly to the point of cruelty, all inside this poor body of mine that was also one, and, alas, no one. Fortunately for Moscarda, and ruefully for the reader, at least the reader who is an outsider, he comes to accept the unreality of everything he had conceived himself to be, and becomes one with all that exists. He no longer thinks, but simply is. This is the only way I can live now, to be reborn moment by moment, to prevent thought from working again inside me. The last paragraph of the novel is an exaltation of his new state of existence. The city is far away. There comes to me occasionally, upon the vesper calm, the sound of its bells. I, however, no longer hear those bells within me, but without, ringing for themselves and perhaps trembling with joy in their resounding cavities, in a beautiful blue sky filled with a warm sun, to the twittering of swallows or swaying heavily to wind and cloud, so high in their aerial belfries. To think of death, to pray. It may be that there is one who yet has need of this, and it is to his need that the bells give voice. I no longer have any such need, for the reason that I am dying every instant, and being born anew and without memories, alive and whole, no longer in myself, but in everything outside. End of story. Things turn out all right for Moscarda. He is now an outsider who has been saved. In his loss of a self, he brings to mind U.G. Krishnamurti, John Wren Lewis, and Suzanne Siegel, those unwitting prodigies who recovered from shocks to their systems, following which the cognitive mechanisms which produce a fictive ego shut down. In these instances, the individual who loses himself is the beneficiary of a rapturous payoff. This is truly a good death, in which someone disappears as a purported self and is reborn as no one. He is content just to exist, and equally content not to exist. But does anyone really believe that Luigi Pirandello knew firsthand his protagonist's state of selfless beatitude? Or is it more likely that he just imagined this ending of a decidedly idealistic tendency? Yet whether Pirandello actually experienced or merely researched the ideal resolution to Moscarda's painful self-consciousness, it is not a resolution available to the reader, who could follow Moscarda's route to salvation step by step and never be delivered to the promised land of the ego dead. If it were so, Pirandello would have discovered the most phenomenal cure ever known for the sufferings especially reserved for humankind. He would have solved every scourge we face as a species. As one might expect, though, he did no such thing. Instead, Pirandello resolved his fairy tale by lowering down a deus ex machina. His book is a moral scam, with mystical transcendence standing in for the prayer Moscarda says he no longer needs. This is what the literary insider offers. In The Tenant, Roland Topor supplies the opposing view of the outsider. When Pirandello's character Moscarda describes his escalating puzzlement over his identity as a horrible drama, his words appear as a formality, a perfunctory gesture that fails to convey the uncanny nature of his situation. In The Tenant, on the other hand, Topor affectingly dramatizes the horror of his non-hero Trolkovsky as he traverses the same terrain as his Italian counterpart. A critical passage in Topor's novel begins with the following sentence. At what precise moment, Trolkovsky asked himself, does an individual cease to be the person he and everyone else believes him to be? A Parisian with a Slavic name, Trolkovsky is an outsider and moves in a world where outsiders are persecuted, as they are in the real world. Hoping to move into a new apartment, one previously occupied by a woman named Simone Schul, who was critically injured and not expected to live, he is made to feel as if he is nobody by the landlord, Monsieur Z, and then by the other residents of this sinister place. By flexing their self-appointed grandiosity, Trolkovsky's persecutors can maintain their own delusional status as somebodies, real persons who are well adapted to the hell they have created for themselves. Anyone who is marked as being outside of the group is fair game for those who would assert their reality over all others. Compare with the psychosocial devices of terror management theory. Yet they too are nobodies. If they were not, their persecutions would not be required. They could pass their lives with a sure mindfulness of their substance and value. But, as any good Buddhist, or even Pirandello's Moscarda, could tell you, human beings have no more substance and value than anything else on earth. The incapacity to repose alongside both the mountains and the mold of this planet is the fountainhead of the torments we wreak on one another. As long as we deny a person or group the claim to be as right and as real as we are, so long may we hold this dreamlike claim for ourselves alone. And it is the duty of everyone to inculcate a sense of being empty of substance and value in those who are not emulations of them. Without being consciously aware of it, Trolkovsky experiences an epiphany at the midpoint of the novel that is inspired by his neighbor's behavior toward him. The bastards, Trolkovsky raged, the bastards, what the hell do they want? For everyone to roll over and play dead? And even that probably wouldn't be enough. He is more right than he knows, because what they want is for everyone to roll over and play them. Martians. They were all Martians. They were strangers on this planet, but they refused to admit it. They played at being perfectly at home. He was no different. He belonged to their species, but for some unknown reason he had been banished from their company. They had no confidence in him. All they wanted from him was obedience to their incongruous rules and their ridiculous laws, ridiculous only to him, because he could never fathom their intricacy and their subtlety. Trolkovsky's neighbors cannot admit to themselves what he comes to realize. Everybody is nobody. No one is empowered to define who he or she is. But people do arrogate to themselves the authority to make a ruling on who you are, and you will stand mute before their bench. From the outset, Trolkovsky is manipulated to accept this verdict. Finally, he pronounces it on himself. To his broken mind, it seems that the only way to defy his neighbor's murderous conspiracy against him is to cooperate in it. He does this by allowing himself to fall from the window of his apartment and through the glass roofing over the courtyard below. The first time does not kill him, so he hauls his bloody anti-self back up the stairs, jeering at his neighbors who have come out to lunge at his body with sharp objects. He then falls a second time from the window. Following in the footsteps of Gloria Beatty, he decides to call it quits in the world's lugubrious game. Interestingly, The Tenant concludes with the same kind of leap beyond the mundane as does One, No One, and 100,000. Sadly for Trolkovsky, it is a leap in the opposite direction. More accurately, it is a leap that does not deliver Topor's protagonist from his horrible drama, but one that catapults him into the outermost nightmare of nobodies. As an insider, Pirandello resolved the theme of One, No One, and 100,000 in a spirit-lifting mode. Imbued with a different consciousness, the outsider can only give us resolutions of a miserablest nature. For the past few slivers of human history, those of us living in what is termed the free world have been allowed to hold disparate world views, but only on the condition that they affirm, directly or indirectly, the survival of the species. They must not be pessimistic, nihilistic, or in any respect skeptical about the livability of human life. Such perspectives might well be valued by outsiders, but insiders, who form the preponderant division of humankind, will not incorporate the outsiders' stark attitudes and unhappy endings into their philosophies, ideologies, national policies, or fraternal bylaws. Both Pirandello and Topor dealt with the identical theme, the transformative dissolution of one's self-concept. The former writer ended his story with a portrait of a man who joyously transcends himself by becoming the No One in the novel's title. This resolution has already been deplored as a put-up job. An insider might say as much about the ending of Topor's novel, which implies a descent into nightmare that Trolkovsky never saw coming. In the epilogue to The Tenant, it turns out that Trolkovsky survives what should have been his death plunge, but he does so in a strange way. Regaining consciousness in a hospital bed, he sees he has a visitor, and now everything comes home to him. Anyone can tell where this is going. The hospital bed where he now reclines is the same one that, at the beginning of the story, he stood beside as he looked over the bandage-hidden body of his apartment's former tenant, whom he wanted to see for himself was not going to recover from her injuries and try to reclaim her old lodgings. She, too, had fallen from the window of that shabby residence. The newly bedridden patient, like the one before, identifies to his horror the one who has come to visit him. It is himself. Immobilized by his injuries and his face dressed to expose only one eye and an opening for his mouth, he realizes that he has changed places with the woman whose apartment he once coveted. Perhaps not for the first time, as he might be caught in a loop of reincarnations, he has come to be at his own bedside. Realizing what has happened to him, the one in the bed, he already knows what is going to happen to the one standing over him, the one who is not him anymore, and yet is. Trolkovsky has now solved his and Mascarda's riddle. At what precise moment does an individual cease to be the person he, and everyone else, believes him to be? Answer: at the moment when an individual becomes conscious that he has been trapped in a paradox of identity, and there is no way out for him as long as he believes himself to be something he is not. Ask any puppet that thinks it is a person. As neither Pirandello nor Topor underwent the transformative dissolution of the self-concept that is the common theme of their stories, it would be the high point of each man's biography if they had. Are they not equally disingenuous? The answer to that question would seem to turn upon which author's representation of the world you deem to be more symbolically well-founded, ending one's days in serene communion with all that makes up the world, or trapped in a damaged body in a hospital bed, unable to do anything but scream at the sight of a clueless wraith, the nobody who was you in the dream that was your life. Whichever conclusion to these thematically analogous stories appears more faithful to human experience depends on who you are, or who you think you are. This is a very Pirandellian theme. While Topor's vision seems empirically sturdier, Pirandello's is the crowd favorite. To receive the prize Pirandello awards Mascarda, if only for a moment before one's death, would make amends for a lifetime of lashings. Grievously, just because something is a desideratum does not mean that believing in it will save you. But Pirandello and his kind want you, and themselves, to die trying. All Topor and his kind have to say is that you should always have your affairs in order, which may bring you some peace of mind if you are confined to a hospital bed, or only looking for a new apartment. Characters. In his essay, The Undelivered, Choran wrote, "The more we consider the Buddha's last exhortation, death is inherent in all created things, labor ceaselessly for your salvation, the more we are troubled by the impossibility of feeling ourselves as an aggregate, a transitory if not fortuitous convergence of elements." Choran could not have been more right about the impossibility of feeling oneself to be a thing of parts, a being made as it is made. Transporting ourselves to and fro on the earth and walking up and down upon it, we are doggedly believable characters, although we are not provably anything more than that. Yet we do seem to be more than that, and seeming is enough for us to get by as we have all these years. In the course of our disillusionments, we have confessed to being bodies made of elementary particles just like everything else, but we must stop short of any tidings that would put us on a par with bacteria and beer mugs. That would be to skyrocket disillusionment out of the atmosphere, leaving us without a speck of our invaluable selves and the games they play. One game that most writers of horror fiction play with their characters is called Good versus Evil, and they play it as if it were the only game in town. Certainly it is the oldest game in town, the one we have relied on for much of our characterization from the time we first knew who we were, or thought we did. A few horror writers, though, play a different game, one in which, as Poe wrote, horror is the soul of the plot, rather than believable characters. The game of good versus evil is about horror in the world, and its players, its characters, are given a fighting chance. The other game is about the horror of the world, and none of its players has a chance, unless by pure chance. For example, compare two horror novels that presume the reality of supernatural possession, William Peter Blatty's The Exorcist and Lovecraft's The Case of Charles Dexter Ward. In the world of Blatty's Good versus Evil novel, certain believable characters are dressed for doom and others for survival. This is a formulaic element of nearly all popular horror novels. Two priests, Fathers Karras and Marin, give their lives to save Regan, a believable characterization of a young girl whose body, and perhaps her soul, the relationship between body and soul among Christian sects is not consistent, has been possessed by a demon or demons. The deaths of these priests are acceptable to readers as part of the story's formula, despite the fact that they are the sort of characters whom ordinary folk care about. Burke Dennings, the director of the movie in which Regan's actress mother, Chris McNeil, stars, is murdered by the possessed Regan. He is not a terribly likable fellow, being a profane and belligerent drunk, so the function he serves is that of a character who can be killed off to advance the narrative in a shocking direction, since the reader does not care much about him, however believable he may be. This is very acceptable to readers, who are within their rights to expect at least one person to be slain over the course of a horror novel. Such is the way that the greater part of those who patronize works of fiction like to see writers handle their characters, believably. They also want a finale in which good wins out over evil, which assures them that the formula, being alive is all right, is the right formula. The case of Charles Dexter Ward is in every way a negation of Blatty's Exorcist. In Lovecraft's novel, the universe cares nothing for human life, just as it is in the real world, and one does not care about the characters. They are only a perspective from which to view the horror of the plot. This is acceptable to very few readers. Good and evil are rubrics of an existential code long gone, just as they are in the real world. Again, this is acceptable to very few readers. And the idea of human beings as creatures with souls is not an issue in the case of Charles Dexter Ward, because it was not an issue for Lovecraft. Everyone, not only the hapless protagonist of the book, exists in a world that is a wall-to-wall nightmare. In Lovecraft's universe without a formula, everyone is killable, and some kill themselves just ahead of the worse things waiting for them. Life as we conceive it, let alone a configuration of atoms that goes by the name Charles Dexter Ward, occurs in a context of permanent jeopardy, which only remains to be discovered, and from which there is no salvation. Lovecraft does not want to take you on an emotional roller coaster ride, at the end of which he tells you to watch your step as your car comes to a stop and you settle back onto steady ground. He simply wants to say that we no longer have to stand back very far to see that the human race is what it always has been in this or any other world, irrelevant, which is as liberating to some as it is maddening to others, including Lovecraft's characters. Lovecraft's employment of supernatural possession as a storytelling device in the case of Charles Dexter Ward is so alien to Blatty's in The Exorcist that the two men might as well have been living in different centuries, or even different millennia. The narrative parameters of The Exorcist begin and end with the New Testament. Those of The Case of Charles Dexter Ward could only have been conceived by a fiction writer of the modern era, a time when it had become safe not only to place humanity outside the center of the creation, but also to survey the universe itself as centerless, and our species as only a smudge of organic materials at the mercy of forces that know us not, just as we are in the real world. As for the special fate of the protagonist of Lovecraft's novel, his possession by his ancestor, Joseph Curwen, a master of occult arts, is only a means to much larger ends that have been eons in the making. As previously imaged, he is just a configuration of atoms, not an ensouled creature of a god who has been toying with us for the past 100,000 years, more or less. Absolutely up to date, that is, post everything, the case of Charles Dexter Ward emerged from an imagination that was deferential to no traditions or dogmas, and its author went the distance of disillusionment in assuming the meaningless universe that became the starting point for later investigators in the sciences and philosophy. Ask the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg, who notoriously said, "The more we know about the universe, the more meaningless it appears." Although Lovecraft did have his earthbound illusions, at the end of the day, he existed in a no-man's land of disillusionment. As a fiction writer, he will ever be a contemporary of each new generation of mortals, because there will always be many a character in the real world for whom human life is not acceptable. Uncharacters. In many horror stories, there is an assortment of figures that appear as walk-ons or extras whose purpose is to lend their spooky presence to a narrative for atmosphere alone, while the real bogey is something else altogether. Puppets, dolls, and other caricatures of the human often make cameo appearances as shapes sagging in the corner of a child's bedroom or lolling on the shelves of a toy store. There are also dismembered limbs and decapitated heads of mannequins that have been relegated to spare parts strewn about an old warehouse where such things are stored or sent to die. As backdrops or bit players, imitations of the human form have a symbolic value because they seem connected to another world, one that is all harm and disorder, the kind of place we sometimes fear is the model for our own home ground, which we must believe is passably sound and secure, or at least not an environment where we might mistake a counterfeit person for the real thing. But in fiction, as in life, mistakes are sometimes made. When they are, one of those humanoid replicas may advance to the center of a story's action. In E.T.A. Hoffman's The Sandman, for instance, the protagonist Nathaniel discovers that the too perfect girl to whom he has proposed marriage is really just an automaton. This shakes him up so greatly that he is committed to an asylum until he recovers his senses. The incident with Nathaniel's mechanical fiancée, a thing of parts who is the creation of two mysterious characters in the story, also shakes up others who are in love with dream girls. As Hoffman's story goes, many lovers, to be quite convinced that they were not enamored of wooden dolls, would request their mistresses to sing and dance a little out of time, to embroider and knit and play with their lapdogs while listening to reading, etc., and above all not merely to listen, but also sometimes to talk in such a manner as presupposed actual thought and feeling. Toward the end of The Sandman, Nathaniel's madness returns, and he leaps to his death from a steeple after screaming, "Turn and turn about, little doll!" There are many abominable fates in horror stories, and among them is that of Nathaniel. Worse still is when a human being becomes objectified as a puppet, a doll, or some other caricature of our species, and enters a world that he or she thought was just a creepy little place inside of ours. What a jolt to find oneself a prisoner in this sinister sphere, reduced to a composite mechanism looking out on the land of the human, or one which we believe to be human by any definition of the word, and to be exiled from it. Just as we know that dreams are merely reflections of what happens in our lives, we are also quite sure that puppets, dolls, and other caricatures of our species are only reflections of ourselves. In a sane world, no correspondence could exist between those artificial anatomies and our natural flesh. That would be too strange and awful for things to become confused in such a way. More strange and awful, of course, would be to find this a living confusion, life as the dream of a puppet.